I'd like to call the meeting to order. You take the seats. I'm representing Paul Gardner, vice chair, but since this is an area where I get to quiz people, Representative Eakin asked me if I could chair this afternoon. Before we get started, could somebody move to approve the minutes for January 20th and January 22nd? Representative Bingham, our new member, would you like to?
Mr. Chair, I would move the minutes of, well, maybe I shouldn't because I wasn't a member on the committee. Maybe it could be someone else. I don't know what went on that day.
We'll let Representative Sterner do that. How is that? Would you be able to move the minutes for the 20th and 22nd?
I'll move the minutes for the 20th and 22nd.
Great. Any discussion of the minutes? Any corrections? All those in favor of approving the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are adopted. We have four presenters today from three agencies. During the last session, we had a drinking water source protection subcommittee of the Environmental Finance Committee, which I chaired, and we could never get a quorum and find a regular time to meet. And so when we were looking to slim down a little bit this year, I offered to the speaker to dissolve that subcommittee so that we could just do things within existing committees, and so it's kind of what we're doing today. There have been some, there's several other agencies that could talk about water, but I asked if Met Council, DNR, and the Department of Health could talk about things that are going on because they've got some new stuff to talk about. Mr. Alverm is going to talk about the Met Council water supply plan. We have DNR talking about overall statewide drinking water monitoring efforts, and then Mr. Stein will be here to talk about the new health risk limits for groundwater, which were just approved recently. Mr. Alverm, welcome to the committee. Could you state your name and affiliation for the record, please?
My name is Chris Alverm. I'm the manager of the water supply planning unit at the Metropolitan Council. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for this opportunity to talk to you today about our regional water supply planning effort that we've been undertaking here in the Twin City metropolitan area. The goal of this effort has been to develop a master water supply plan, which is currently in draft form, and I'll get to that in a minute. It's been a collaborative effort. The other two agencies that you'll hear from today have been two of our key partners in development of this plan. We've also had input from other state agencies, county, and local officials, as well as our Water Supply Advisory Committee, which has provided valuable input to our development of this plan. I'll start off with the conclusions, which always seems kind of contrary to me, but it seems to be a good way to do things. So our plan concludes that overall we have supplies available to meet projected demands for the future. We are fortunate to have a relatively abundant supply in the metro area. We have multiple groundwater aquifers. We have three major rivers, as well as hundreds of lakes and streams. However, that water is not always available where we want it. Those aquifers aren't contiguous across the metro area, and growth is not necessarily occurring where our resources are most plentiful. So our plan sets up a process for identifying issues that need to be addressed and also steps to address those issues. We had a public comment period back in November and December on our plan, and we received several very productive and constructive comments. I think the general sense was that we're on the right track. The plan is useful. We also generally we have support for the effort. Planning on a regional scale makes sense. The communities themselves have done a lot of work to plan their supply system, but have not looked regionally at supply availability, and that's where our effort has filled the gap. There was also comments throughout our planning efforts that made it clear that there's not support for the Met Council to take over water supply as a metropolitan system. There's a desire to maintain that local control, so this is kind of the tightrope that we've walked. And I think what we have done with this plan is come up with guidance for communities, no new requirements necessarily, but put out there existing requirements that the DNR and the Health Department specifically have used in the past and will, based on the issues that identified, likely require similar conditions. So what it does is basically addresses the issue that communities have moved forward with development based on Met Council's forecast for sewer and transportation, but water supply hadn't been considered as part of that regional planning. And so issues have come up at the point when the community is essentially already installed wells and the DNR has to make a decision about appropriation. What we've done is brought to light those issues, for instance, impacts to surface water. We have done a technical analysis. We have collected a lot of information and developed analytical tools, including a regional groundwater model, to bring to light those issues and also identify steps to take to address those issues. And those steps, again, are not necessarily new requirements, but are based on conditions that the DNR has put on appropriations in the past. I'll give you a few examples of how our plan works. I have a handout in your packet, which it has a cover page. It's called Community Water Supply Profiles. This is really the backbone or the nuts and bolts of our plan, and then there's four profiles in here. And these are contained in the plan as an appendix. There is a water supply profile for each community in the metropolitan area. And we'll start with, if I just run through these quickly, give you an idea of how our plan intends to address water supply issues in the region. Savage, for instance, the first one. There's information about past and projected water demands, about the current sources of supply, about projected or future available sources, and then on the bottom there are several issues listed, and these issues were identified through our technical analysis and based on experience that communities may have faced or that we have prior knowledge of. And for the city of Savage, you can see that there's several issues listed, including potential decline in the aquifer levels and impact of surface water features. Now, the city of Savage is well aware of these issues and has been dealing with them for several years. The city happens to contain a trout stream as well as a calcareous wetland, which is a protected surface water feature that relies on groundwater. And so they have actually had some limitations placed on their appropriations in the past. So we can use this as an example of something that we want to put out there for other communities so that they can learn from Savage's experience. So if you look at the next one, Cottage Grove, for instance, they have a similar set of issues identified, and what we have done then is based on these issues, the community would then look at another appendix in the plan and determine what steps to take, which would include the kind of things that Savage has undertaken, including monitoring to determine whether or not these impacts are occurring as predicted. Savage has also pursued alternative sources. They have used other aquifers. They've recently developed a surface water system with their neighbor Burnsville and the Kramer Quarry through a partnership. And so Cottage Grove will now be on notice that they need to address these issues as part of their water supply planning efforts. If you look at the next one, the city of Plymouth has no water supply issues related to quantity, but we have noted that their wellhead protection area, or their because of their geology, their groundwater sources have a potential vulnerability to contamination. And this is through a program already administered by the Minnesota Department of Health, a wellhead protection program, which identifies aquifer vulnerability. And what this profile does then is essentially gives another opportunity to make note of this condition, so these communities will know that this is another thing that they need to address. In most cases, they are already addressing it through their wildlife protection plan, but it will also give the opportunity for other land use decisions to understand that this is something they should consider to protect water supplies. Finally, the city of Afton, which has no municipal supply and no intention to develop one, but we have developed profiles for all communities so that if plans change in the city of Afton, or if, for instance, a large water-using industry or some other water-using activity is proposed, they'll have this information available, so they'll know that even though it's not necessarily something the city has to consider, the city through land use planning or other reviews by other agencies will know that there is a concern about impact to a trout stream, for instance, if there's going to be significant withdrawal in that community, and that their neighbor, that because of the regional impact of declines on the aquifer, that adding to that decline may be a problem. So this information will be available, and again, there are steps to take to address those issues in the plan. One of the benefits of our planning effort has been the development of a significant base of technical information and the analytical tools. We've developed a regional groundwater model, which is really the second version of a groundwater model that was developed by the PCA in the late 90s. It's also been a collaborative effort, which I think has brought a lot of issues to light and a lot of diverse interests together to develop a plan that is workable and usable. What the plan also does is set up a process for ongoing evaluation. In the metro area, we're fortunate to have a relatively good understanding of our water supplies. However, it's still a complex natural system, and we are modeling it. We are making lots of assumptions about what the impacts of withdrawals will be. And so as we move forward, we need to have a dynamic plan that is adaptable. As we learn more about the system, our concepts will change. We will come up with new issues that need to be addressed. We'll have to come up with creative ways to address them. And so that plan sets forth that process to fill in the gaps we've identified and to update our information so that our decisions can be made on the best available information. Again, I thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Elvrum. Representative Greenies had a question, and I have a couple.
Thank you. I note still that you are only planning for 40 years, and so you're not planning for a child born today who will only be about halfway through their lifetime. I also note that when you're looking at the populations of each of these areas, they're going up, and you've not projected from the increased population. So, my question is, do you have any better projections than this? Like, the life of a child today, maybe 80 or 90 years? Do you have long-term projections? Like, are we sustainable for... Are we generally sustainable? Because we're not getting that, whether we're generally sustainable or whether they're sustainable for a child born today.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we use the 2050 projections because we actually had numbers to base those projections on, but we also did, just for our information and to address that very question, we did what we're calling an ultimate projection. We have made a lot of assumptions about land use and population densities for the developing parts of the metro area and essentially saturated it with a suburban type development and made some assumptions about withdrawals and did run that with our groundwater model. And what we found is that similar issues arise. The areas that we have planned for out to 2050, most of those are fully developed by 2050. So what we see is that they'll need to address those issues, but that those issues then extend out to other areas. We don't see widespread decline in the aquifers. And in fact, again, this is our assumptions right now that go into the model, but based on that ultimate scenario, we don't see a long-term regional sustainability issue. We see it as more addressing these more local issues. That's also assuming one thing that we probably will be doing is growing up in the core. We don't have a good sense of what that means for projections and up even in the suburbs. So those densities may increase significantly, and there may be other problems that we haven't identified. So I would say we have done that. I wouldn't certainly consider that to be a perfect analysis that we should just rest on for any length of time, but we have an ongoing process to further improve that understanding.
Is it Paul, Representative Phoenix? Go ahead.
Well, I noticed for each one of these, like Savage from 2004, you're almost having a double of a population. You're seeing problems between now and 2004 and 2050, and if you double the population, you don't see problems. Somehow that's not meeting the common sense test.
Mr. Elverum.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I would say that we do have a pretty prolific groundwater system here. We have, 2.5 million people that are served, well, two-thirds of that served by groundwater right now. And we do have problems. We have those issues like in Savage where they can't take more water out of the Perry St. Jordan offer because they will impact that fen, that calcareous wetland. But to be honest, we don't see a widespread decline in the aquifer level on a regional scale. So adding another 2.5 million people, I'm not going to say that, yes, it'll be fine, there won't be any problems, but based on based on what we understand right now, we don't predict that to be a sustainability. Widespread, we're going to run out of water. It's going to be local issues that we need to address.
To that point, Representative Higgins?
Yes. The question isn't, are we going to run out of water? Then I think the question becomes, what's your definition of sustainability? And it seems to me it's saying, well, as long as there's water for us right now, and the question is there water for populations 100 years from now at the same level? And that's what I'm trying to get at. And actually, it'd be much more helpful if you just not answer now, but put it in writing and show me what you've got.
Yeah. Give Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What are the names of the model or models that you're using for hydrology?
Mr. Elton.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we used a mod flow-based groundwater model, which is the USGS version. It's really the industry standard for groundwater modeling. And we also used a USGS model to estimate groundwater recharge, which is a new method, soil water balance. It took in land use, soils, topography, hydrology, and things. So the groundwater model is pretty standard for use, and it was really a change from the PCA model that they used in the late 90s. And it's one of the reasons we wanted to update it to use that more well-accepted groundwater model.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just offer you a little bit of a caution. We've been using that for 20 years on a Superfund site, and it didn't prove out. So, do some ground truthing with it.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Elverum, any idea what this effort that you've undertaken, and I realize that you've got statutory direction to do that, what does it cost the state of Minnesota to do this work?
Mr. Elverum.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the effort was funded by existing council funds, and we had a $2 million fund that was a housing fund that was no longer being used for several years, and the legislature authorized us to use it for this effort. We still have about $700,000 left of that, so $1.3 million would be the price tag I estimate right now. 3 years.
Follow-up, Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Due to your work, are there any direct and then maybe follow-up indirect changes in plans or directions for the cities that you study? And a follow-up question to that would be, what does 473.1565 authorize you to do in terms of the length of your work in this area? Is there a sunset provision, et cetera? Thanks.
Mr. Elverum.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the first question about immediate changes, I think, was the question, as a result of our plan or changes in plans. One of the things we addressed early on, one of the first analyses we did was the city of Ramsey, because there was concern that their growth would not be supported by the groundwater resources available. And this was, based on our analysis, we determined that, yes, the groundwater supplies do seem to be sufficient to support their projected demands, However, there may be an impact to surface water features, so that the DNR and the city, as a result, have set up a monitoring program to ensure that impact didn't occur. The other thing that happened over the course of these 3 years is that growth slowed significantly. So Ramsey, who was thinking they were going to need 3 new wells by 2010, is not thinking they're going to need those wells by 2020. And so we have, I think, identified some issues that will need to be addressed, and the urgency has been reduced in many cases. I don't think most of the things we brought up are surprises to most communities, that those that were already developing supplies knew that they had trout streams or something that they needed to address. So I would say that generally there might be some communities that will have to do more monitoring than they were planning on, but not necessarily a change in plans where they'd have to not grow or not be able to use the source immediately. The second question was?
I think the sunset of the Water Supply Advisory Committee is 2010.
The end of 2010, the advisory committee. However, the statute requires that the Met Council update the master water supply plan I don't think it actually has a date for updating the plan, but it requires that we report back to the legislature every 5 years. So we consider this a long-term, ongoing effort, and have a plan and process placed to continue that for the future.
Follow-up, Representative Juskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the other $700,000, any idea what's going to happen with that, and what will the cost of the five-year updates be to the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Elvin.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we have a chapter dedicated in the plan to ongoing efforts. As I mentioned, our analysis used a lot of great information and developed these tools. It also, the one benefit is it identified where we know the least about our available sources. So, for instance, geologic mapping in the western part of the metro area is a need. They rely on glacial material for their water supplies. We don't really know. They're kind of isolated bodies. So we know we need to do that work. Our estimation of recharge is good, but it needs to be improved, because that's really the ultimate limitation on our supplies, how much is getting into the aquifers. So there are a number of studies, monitoring, and analyses that we would use that $700,000 and projected between $500,000 and $750,000 to maintain a program. We have 3 staff at the council that have been working on this per year, so $750,000 roughly per year to maintain this effort and then provide that updated information periodically.
If I could cut to the chase here, too, I did manage to print off the governor's budget for the, if you go to the Department of Finance site and look under the Met Council on pages 10 and 11, they've got all the detail on how you would do that, including the $750 in fiscal 2011. I had a couple for you. I was actually really impressed with the work that you've done with this Metro Model Tool software. And I know it's based on a lot of assumptions on what you think is happening, and so you can tweak that as time goes on. Is that something that could be used on a regional basis elsewhere in the state? Is that something that the DNR or other agencies could use?
Mr. Chair, committee members, the model itself, that particular model is focused on the metropolitan area. We are fortunate to have some hydrogeologic boundaries. The major rivers are kind of barriers to groundwater flow. The aquifers pinch out to the north and west, so we can kind of define an area based on groundwater flow regimes. That model itself could not be just simply picked up and put somewhere else in the state. The idea or the concept and the process could be you always want to develop a model to answer specific questions, and we did so for this case, and we did it regionally, but if you were to go to western Minnesota, for instance, you might end up with a series of small models because of the aquifer extents are much less in aerial extent than they are here in the metro area. So you would probably still use ModFlow. You'd still collect the similar types of information, build a model to answer the similar types of questions, but it would be for that purpose and for that area.
Thanks. You know, the other thing that I liked about this plan, I mean, it's always revised as you have more data is that, you know, all our cities tap into either an aquifer or the river, but we never really know what effect we're having on somebody else. And so this is a, I'm not an engineer or anything, or a geologist or a hydrologist, but I just had a better understanding as a layman after I looked through all your appendices and everything, and understanding which way things are moving and how the impacts of one community affect another. So, you know, I hope as you move forward with your supply plan that you continue to speak English to us about through these profiles. I hope that those are pretty helpful. And if you go online to see this, every one of your cities, if you're in the 7-county metro, has a water supply profile. So I got to see how many wells my communities are going to have to build in the next couple of years. The one thing that you say in the report is that there are some areas that are going to be short of water. And could you just identify which parts of the metro area those are?
Mr. Chair, one area that I think we're probably in the near future is Woodbury Cottage Grove. They happen to be in an area where they have a kind of an isolated recharge area. Water flows both towards the Mississippi and the St. Croix. They have trout streams, a lot of growth planned. And so I think that will probably be an area where a creative solution will be need to be identified. Woodbury has already taken a lot of steps to protect the trout stream, and they recognize an area that's essentially off limits to additional wells in the Prairie du Chien Jordan aquifer. The South Metro has a lot of growth, the Lakeville area. Past experience with interference, something that we want to pay attention to. There's the Vermilion River, parts of it are designated trout streams. The northern parts of that area, Savage and Shakopee, have trout streams. And again, potential issues with drawdown on a regional basis that we'll have to continue to evaluate. One of the ways we have addressed this in the plan is we haven't based a limitation on a supply on the model, because there is that uncertainty with the model, but we have, if the model predicts a situation like a significant drawdown for the future, the first step they would have to take is to install monitoring wells. And I think that goes to the point made earlier that this our models, you know, and the Superfund site, they don't always work out right, but they are a very good predictor, and they help us to identify steps so we can use real-world information to determine whether this is going to occur as predicted.
Representative Bingham had a question. And Representative Paymar and Representative Bingham have switched off, so welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to serve on the committee. I share Cottage Grove with Representative McNamara. I'm just wondering, what kind of discussions have you had with the city of Cottage Grove over your concerns? I know that this is a topic that's on the radar, but I was just wondering if you have had any meetings about this situation.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we have not had a specific conversation with Cottage Grove. The city of Woodbury, through their technical work group for many years, has been addressing it in their community, and we actually had a request from the Washington County to start a East Metro Water Supply Work Group, and this would be modeled on the Southwest Metro Work Group, which we've had in place for 11 or 12 years now, and one in the Northwest Metro. So we intend to start that as soon as the plan wraps up, and try to get those communities and other interested parties together to start discussing what information they're gathering, and then ultimately come up with a solution to meet all the needs.
Representative Bingham has a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What timeline are you looking at with that working group?
Mr. Chair, the work group, I would say early summer. We'll be able to get on that fairly quickly. The county has been very active in addressing groundwater, and so I think they're a very valuable partner over there. And when Woodbury started discussing the issue, we offered to start a work group, and I don't think Woodbury got the Met Council was the appropriate convener of that. Maybe they have changed their mind a little bit, but on a regional basis, I think we're well set up to do that.
I had one last comment. The one thing that I really highlighted in bold in your draft plan, has the final plan been approved yet?
No, it hasn't.
Okay, so we're still working on the draft. You say, not surprisingly, analysis results indicate that continued use of traditional sources to meet increasing water demand in the Twin Cities metro area will lower water levels in aquifers. The drawdown is likely to be most pronounced primarily in the outer suburbs where high growth is projected. And then you talk about some of the high-risk ones. That is the kind of thing that triggered Representative Wagenius and me to talk a little bit about what's sustainable. And I guess when we see the aquifers are dropping, our question is, where's the bottom, you know? And I don't know if the Metro Model 2 or further iterations would be able to give us an idea as we do think about the next generation.
If I may, Mr. Chair, the interesting thing, one of my colleagues said, you should be careful using the word drawdown because, you know, people are concerned when they hear that. However, every time you pump a well, there is drawdown, and it's not necessarily that it's bad. I'm thinking too, we monitor water levels all the time, and we find that as you increase pumping in an area, you'll see drawdown. However, if that pumping stabilizes and our aquifers are essentially recharging either from above or from adjacent aquifers below, that drawdown can level off. And so even though we have cones of depression in our developed suburbs, those have essentially leveled off in many cases. And as you grow and add pumping, you can start increasing that drawdown again, which may be a problem.
Very good. Representative Venus, you had a question? We'd like to wrap up so we can get on to the DNR.
Well, just my observation would be that you can draw down and it might recharge, but given the metropolitan area and how polluted it is, the danger is your recharged water is polluted. And you haven't addressed that. I haven't heard that being addressed by you.
Mr. Overman, any comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius. That's true. Our effort was not focused on water quality, and you're right. As we're the water that's soaking in right now, we'll be drinking in 10, 20, 30, 40 years, depending on where you are. And it certainly is not the same quality as it was 100 years ago. So that's something that needs to be continually monitored.
Quick follow-up.
It's not a matter of monitoring it. That actually, because it's not the same quality, it may be contaminating the water that is of good quality. So when you're drawing down and pulling in more surface water coming into the groundwater, you may be contaminating the very aquifer that we'll be using in the future. So I don't hear you addressing all the questions. It's a troubling thing.
Maybe you can just note that for the record, Mr. Elvin, so we can move on. Although it sounds like you have a framework into which you can input data as you move along. So.
Yes. Okay.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I have Julie Ekman from DNR. The Health Department and the DNR collaborating. One of the handouts while we're waiting that I got put in here was something from a Fresh Water Society report that just came out on showing 1991 to 2005 groundwater use, millions of gallons, and saw golf courses as the chief growth area. Just FYI. Do we need to get somebody?
Nope. We're just waiting for all the security measures to work their way through.
You know all about quarantining and stuff at the Department of Health?
Yeah, to minimize risk.
Great. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name and affiliation for the tape, please.
My name is David Luthi. I'm the Technical Resources Section Administrator for DNR Division of Water.
I'm Julie Ekman. I am the Water Permit Program Supervisor for the DNR Division of Water.
And we're tag-teaming because it's an integrated approach. Even though there's two separate items, we'll address them as we go.
Fire away.
The title of our talk today is Drinking Water Protection, Managing Water Quantity to Ensure Adequate Sources of Quality Water for Future Generations, tying into the drinking water concern. Just for reference purposes, Minnesota Statute 23G265 essentially says that we need to make sure there's enough for everybody. And that is increasingly a challenge as water quantity and water quality issues come together in sustainability discussions. And so you heard Mr. Elbrum talk about the metropolitan area. We'll address the rest of the state and including the metropolitan area and some of the methods that we are employing to address these issues. What we're doing to manage water supplies right now is we have a three-pronged approach, basically managing through permitting water supply plans and water conservation rate structures. We do monitoring, including climate, stream flow, groundwater, and lake levels. And we do mapping and modeling activities that support that through groundwater studies, county atlases, and regional atlases, as well as watershed mapping and hydrologic studies to understand how water moves. And Julie Exum will take us now through the permitting management, water supply, and water conservation rate structures.
Okay, well, the first item that was mentioned under the managing portion is our permitting program. Permits are required for water use in a state that exceeds 10,000 gallons a day or 1 million gallons in a year. We also require a submittal of a water use report on an annual basis from the permitted water users. This slide is also in your packet. It's an example of some of the data that we receive, and we do, with the data, we publish reports on water use, a summary report on a two-year basis. We also publish the water use data on our website, and this data is widely used by other agencies and individuals. It allows us to compare water use by various sectors. We're showing here public water supply, and you can see how water use by public water suppliers has increased over the past 14 years by about 60 billion gallons a year. Another management tool that we utilize are the water supply plans. This is different from what NetCounsel is doing in the metro area, but it is also integrated with what they are doing. Water supply plans are required from all communities that public water suppliers that service more than 1,000 people. We are currently in the second generation of the water supply plans. The first generation plans were required in 1996, and the focus this time now is on water sustainability and on conservation. When we have growing communities that are submitting their plans, what we're looking for are a means to monitor their resources so that they can ensure that their growth can be sustained with their water supplies. And we look for places where we can recommend additional monitoring of their water supply and where they might be siting new wells. If there are potentials for water supply issues in that community, we'd also want to encourage more monitoring. Conservation goals must be addressed in their water supply plans. And some of the indicators that we look for are they managing their water losses. We want to keep that down. Water losses can occur through old systems with leaky pipes. Sometimes it just appears that they're losing water, but maybe they forgot to report certain uses that are occasional, like water hydrant flushing. And we also want them to show us that they have beefed up their conservation efforts, either through education or maybe retrofit programs, and also the conservation rate structure adoption. And in your handouts, you have a conservation rate handout that you can refer to for this. When the statute amendment, 103G291, went into effect last August, we notified all the communities that have public water supply systems serving more than 1,000 people that they would be required to adopt the conservation rate on the timeline stated in the statute. That's 2010 for communities in the metro area and 2013 for all other communities. The additional requirement of that law is that when a community comes to us for an amendment to their water supply permit, they have to adopt a conservation rate at that time if they're increasing their volume or if they're adding another well. We developed guidance, such as what is in your handout, to help communities, and we get examples of each of the conservation rate types that are named in the statute. This is a work in progress. We're finding that some communities are having some issues trying to meet this statutory requirement. We're listening to them, and we're trying to address their need for some flexibility on this. Some communities have been doing a really good job of conserving water, even if they don't have a conservation rate. So we are we're progressing on this, and we're working with them to try to come to some kind of decision on what we can approve
for them.
Can I ask
what the nature of the issues are that they're having to grapple with on that?
Well, some of them are coming to this with large blocks of water included in a base fee, for example. We don't consider that a conservation rate, but some of them say that it is a hardship for them to change their rate based on things, factors that we hadn't considered, software that they're trying to use, for example, doesn't allow them to tweak things very well. Some of them want to include a base, a volume at their base rate to offer what they call a lifeline volume for people on fixed incomes, for example. So our examples say that if you include base volume in your rate, that it's not a conservation rate. But
my concern on this was that a lot of those communities are not recovering their fixed cost for the connection to the house through their base rate. They're relying on people who pay more for water to cover that. And it's kind of progressive in a way, which is okay, but I'm concerned that I just read a GAO report that thousands of communities around the country aren't doing that either, and so they don't have enough money to upgrade their infrastructure over time, and so they're stuck. Does that sound accurate?
Mr. Chair, that's one piece, but yes.
Okay.
Another issue is that some have come to us recently for permit amendments, which would trigger the requirement for a conservation rate, and they're saying that the timing is off for them, so we're trying to work with them, and if they can give it to us in writing that they will be adopting a conservation rate and the timeline that the statute says, then we've been willing to accept that. Conservation rates are a step in the right direction. They're a piece of the overall conservation effort and sustainability effort, and we are going to need some time to assess their effectiveness. Conservation rates are just one part of a conservation effort.
We'll move now to, we talked about management tools that we were using. Monitoring is another piece of understanding water availability and helping us, it will be necessary to help us address sustainability ultimately. We have four primary monitoring areas that we collect data in. There's climate. We have an extensive volunteer precipitation measurement by the people of Minnesota. We have stream flow measurements at major watershed level for the state. We have extensive lake level monitoring programs to help keep track of lake level statewide and fluctuations. And we also have a groundwater monitoring network. The slide, at least on the screen here, shows the existing monitoring well network. It is a variety of bedrock, buried artesian wells, and water tables. I will cover at least the diversity of aquifers in the state in a moment here, but the system we have is not adequate for really understanding the groundwater systems, but it is a start. We need to have a more robust that effort. We're looking at minimum levels of potentially four wells, deep wells and shallow wells per county would be a start towards that direction. Even more wells will be needed ultimately if we're going to understand how the aquifers work, how they respond to pumping, and competition for use as that increases.
I also printed out your budget recommendation here, and the Clean Water Fund would have be $1.5 million in the out years, but you're talking about 100 observation wells for automated water level readings. That would be part of your effort to expand this network?
Yes.
Is that enough? How many monitoring wells would help you statewide really understand what you need to know?
It's a difficult question. I guess that in the more intense appropriation areas where demand is high and growth is high, we would tend to need more. In areas of outstate where maybe growth is slower and demand is less, we certainly wouldn't need that same level of detail. And so obviously the more water appropriation demand there is, the more competition for supply, the more intense monitoring we need. And so we would probably need to concentrate in certain areas.
Got a question from Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with the observation wells, first, the map that you have only is DNR observation wells. There are other agency observation wells, is that correct?
Yes, there are other observation wells. Most of these wells we acquired from the U.S. Geological Survey when they did more detailed studies, and then they were done with them. We took them over. We've also acquired additional wells in key places when people were looking at not using them anymore and they were abandoning them. But there are other observation wells that could potentially be used to expand that network.
As a follow-up, I'm sorry, could you pronounce your name again for me, sir?
Lucy.
And Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lucy. So is there any case where there may be two agencies going to the same observation well, doing sampling throughout the year? Or is there coordination between agencies to make sure that the same well isn't being sampled?
Mr. Lucy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, we increasingly look for shared opportunities to use wells, particularly if we're in the Mount Simon. They're very deep wells, they're very expensive, and so we want to maximize all wells that we would have for as many uses as possible. Yesterday I was talking to the Department of Ag about using some of our data monitoring equipment for soil probe sensors as well. So we look for opportunities to share resources, share monitoring points, but different agencies and programs need different information for different things that they're attempting to accomplish, and not all wells will work for every use that's out there, but we do attempt to maximize that.
Representative Hansen.
And then finally, Mr. Chair, so when you would establish a new well, is that DNR or health staff, or are you contracting with various local contractors, local well drillers to go out and punch the well? If we had dollars that were going out for 100 observation wells, does that go to the private sector to ripple through the economy with contracts, or is that happening in-house, or a combination of the two?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, it's happening in all ways, but primarily I think that we don't have equipment for a lot of well drilling. We have a shallow rig that we can use for limited situations, but primarily when we are doing drilling, it's coordinated through us but contracted by private individuals or well drillers.
I've got the Representative Regis and Representative Saylor.
Yes, this morning in Environment Finance, we saw a chart that said that we have about 700 wells over the state now, and I thought it was 1,200 that we needed. My quick math says that 500 more that we needed. Do I have the figure wrong?
Our current observation well network is about 750, and at a minimum level, I think we have proposed that up around 1,200 would be an increase. And so, yes, there would need to be more wells if we're to better understand the aquifers statewide.
If I could follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Virginia.
Well, the question actually is to you. Was the proposal for just 100 wells over what time period?
Well, over the, you know, to be honest, I want to make sure I get it right, but page 14 of the DNR budget says equip 100 observation wells, and I'm assuming that's for fiscal 2010 and 2011, although I don't know for sure. Mr. Luthe, does that sound right?
Chairman Gardner. The 100 of monitoring would be to instrument them with data loggers and equipment so that we can understand what's actually happening on a real-time basis. Representative Lugenius, the question would be is that we need more wells of all types, but some of them with real-time data enables us to understand what's happening. It's only read, we have a number of wells that are read currently by the Soil and Water Conservation District and the Cooperation, but it's once a month. And so that tells us a limited data set, but as we would understand more real-time what's happening, you can see trends or if there's something impacts or changes on a shorter time frame, which gives you a better understanding of how the aquifer responds. And so 100 was instrumented, but we would need a more robust system of, and there would probably need to be monitoring volunteers, other ways that we would help collect that information into the system so we could provide better answers back.
Follow-up, Representative Lugenius?
Yeah, so what I'm hearing is you asked for instrumentation for 100 wells, but you did not ask for any new wells, so we would still be at the 700 in some level.
Mr. Luthe?
I'll need to get more clarification on the answer to that question. I'll get back to you.
I'd be happy to pass down the thing from the governor's budget if it helps any.
Well, I think that that's something that...
I apologize to tell you, but I don't see it.
I think that's an important thing for us as a public policy to figure out, do we really want this monitoring, and is that a good expenditure for the new money? And I know this isn't the finance committee, but I would think this is something that we would want to weigh in on. And then there was Representative Hanson's, I think, suggestion that if we dig a well, now, it provides a job for somebody.
I'm
getting in line. Did I get that right?
Very good. Mr. Stein is brimming with information there, but Representative Saylor, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have a question for Mr. Stein when he's... Not Mr. Stein, I'm sorry, Mr. Luthe. My question is, what has driven the pattern of well placement here? Was it a response to questions or problems with quality or quantity or both? Was it, you know, what? When you look at this map, you see some definite patterns, and I'm just wondering what has driven it. There are certainly some areas that one might think would have wells that don't, and I'm wondering why in particular and what drove it. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Taylor, primarily the wells came from more detailed U.S. Geological Survey studies. When we understood that there might be water supply issues in those areas in the past, we did more detailed studies and wells were placed in those areas. And so that is the general pattern of where those wells came from.
Hope we could move along at
okay.
Is another 3 minutes good?
I'll move quickly.
Okay.
I guess that the another area that we work on is mapping and modeling. So when we collect this information, we need to turn it into usable format so people understand. And so we develop 20 geologic atlases. Many of you are maybe familiar with those, and they help local units of government make better decisions. We also, there's a lot of technical analysis that goes into producing those that requires some time too, but we're continuing to expand our understanding of the states and the geologic systems and the hydrologic systems and how they work together to answer questions as they arise, and more questions are arising. So where do we need to go to address water sustainability? I know the committee and the EQB and others are concerned about longer term. Just some thoughts here is that the quality of our water is threatening the quantity. We're responsible again for making sure there's enough for everybody to go around. As impairments to our aquifers and water surface water systems have occurred, it has driven people to the aquifers that have clean water. It's expensive to treat once it's impaired, and so there's a tendency for people to move to the cleaner aquifers, and we see people looking for those as opposed to the treatment options for existing systems. And so as we attempt, as the DNR, to manage quantity, part of the interagency coordination that comes from that is the need to work with the Department of Ag and Health, PCA and others to manage the quality as well, so that we are working together to overcome some of the problems that are there. On the average, 4 trillion gallons of water is supplied annually through precipitation over the state. The average of 27 inches per year if you look at the state as a whole. It's, as you can see from the map, it's not evenly distributed. And so in combination with that, the groundwater provinces, areas of the state, the green areas are part of the regional, there's deeper and more regional aquifers there in the Twin Cities areas. What's with those? The blue area is more shallow superficial sands outwashed from the glaciers that have some water supplies. They don't have deeper aquifers there. The brown areas are in the western part of the state, and those are buried river channels outwashed from the glaciers. There's much more limited aquifers in those areas. And up in the northeast, there is virtually no groundwater or not reliable groundwater supplies. And so taking precipitation and the geology into play, it creates a challenge in how we manage the system going forward. Despite the abundant supply of water, we do see aquifers declining and demand increasing. The question is why, and as I pointed out, is that we continue to move off of systems that cost more to treat and that become impaired, and we are focusing our energies and our appropriations on the limited aquifers we have left. And so there's a reason to be concerned about that. I've heard it from Representative Lugenius and others before. We need to work as agencies, as local units of government, as the federal government as well, to make better land use management decisions to treat these water supplies so that they do get replenished with better quality of water, because we have to depend on them for long term, and we need to be careful about managing the limited aquifers we have left in terms of quality supplies to make sure that they last for drinking water and health, safety, welfare. So with that, just a slide to emphasize. We have different departments who do different things. The Department of Agriculture works on with the Health Department and the PCA on the water supply, public health, pesticides, fertilizers, pollutants, and the department is working in combination, coordinating with those agencies to help them understand the quantity issues, how water moves, so that we can come to a better solution. So.
Thanks for this one chart, because usually it took like 20 pages for agencies to tell us who did what and the statutory requirements and all that. Is that your final slide?
That is.
Thank you. I wanted to ask one final question, and then we need to move on to stay on time. Does the DNR need to issue a permit if let's say, the southwestern part of the state or the Fargo-Moorhead metropolitan area imports water from, say, the Missouri River Basin? Do they need to get a permit and therefore implement some conservation measures to show some needs?
I've been around for a long time, and I know those areas, and I know that the Lewis and Clark project will bring water into southwestern Minnesota. It's a utility at that point, so I don't know that we... I'll have to check with my boss. I don't think that we're going to probably require a permit to deliver water in a pipe that's coming from someplace else, but that does not remove the need for those communities to still do water conservation measures and manage the supplies that they do have.
Great. Thanks so much for coming. And I'm sure people can track you down if we have follow-up questions, too. And now, time to hurl. Mr. Stein, health risk limits.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Langstein, the Director of Environmental Health at the Minnesota Department of Health. Today, with me today is Paul Moyer. He's an exposure risk scientist with our agency and has worked extensively on our health risk limits. We're here to talk about health risk limits for groundwater, which is a function of health protection. And the mission of the Minnesota Department of Health and our commissioner, Dr. Sandy Magnan, is to protect, maintain, and improve the health of all Minnesotans. And one of the ways we do that is by looking at issues associated with the chemistry and the quality of the water that we ingest. That's our primary, one of the primary sources of sustaining our life, and we need to assure that the water we drink is safe. many people are not familiar, may not be familiar with public health as an industry and as environmental health as a subset of public health. So let me give you a little brief explanation. There's environmental health is the governmental programs that are designed to protect the public, meaning people, from hazards which exist or could exist in the physical environment. We work very closely with other agencies in government. Our primary federal agency partners are the Center for Disease Control and Prevention of Illness, that way also the United States Environmental Protection Agency, our primary federal partners. In state government, we interact extensively with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and the Minnesota DNR. Drinking water program, as far as management in the state, has a long history. There was a law passed and established the Minnesota State Board of Health in 1972 to try to reduce waterborne and foodborne diseases. And many people will say that the change in life expectancy that's occurred in the United States and worldwide, really since the turn of the 20th century, was a result of improvement of water safety and water treatment. And so when we talk about water, we're talking about water at the molecular level. We're talking about that we bring into our bodies and what's attached to it or what's exposed to it. Just a couple of brief slides on the history of the program. And by the way, I believe you do have a set of our slides in your handouts if you want to follow along. So I'll try to provide those for you. The key date here is in 1976 when Minnesota accepted primacy for the enforcement of the Safe Drinking Water Act. Just like the Pollution Control Agency has primacy for the implementation of the Clean Water Act, meaning the portions of that act that address clean water for the resources of Minnesota, the ecology of Minnesota, they have the responsibility for wastewater treatment under the federal act. Minnesota Department of Health is the primacy agency for drinking water administration. So we have primacy from the EPA in the enforcement of the State Drinking Water Act. These are the authorities that exist in statute and rule in Minnesota. These are the statutory responsibilities that we follow, and there are a number of them. I won't go into them. But I do want to talk about where Minnesotans get their drinking water. They get drinking water from surface water sources. About 25% of all Minnesotans drink water that comes from surface waters. Those are primarily the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and very closely associated suburbs are drinking water from the Mississippi River. St. Cloud obtains its water from the Mississippi River. A number of communities along the Red River of the North drink surface waters out of the Red River. And then the northeastern part of the state, Duluth and the Arrowhead, drink water from Lake Superior, and then also treated water from at resorts in the Northeast. 2.7 million Minnesotans drink community water that's from wells. When the DNR talks about public water suppliers, those are the folks who we're talking about here, is community well water systems. We're also talking then about 1.2 million Minnesotans drink water from private wells. That's about 23% of our population. These are some of the ways that we assure that the public receives safe drinking water. We work with community water systems and non-community systems, private well owners and contractors. Many people are unfamiliar with what a non-community water system is. Non-community means members of the public are drinking that water. Might be a park, might be a church, might be a restaurant, it might be a daycare facility. So there are people up from the public or workers who are routinely consuming that water. That's called a non-community water system. Community water system then is one that's owned by the government and administered by the government. And private well owners, obviously, those are residents. There are 965 community water systems in the state with 7,000 sources. A source is a well or a point of taking from a surface water. There are 6,300 non-community water systems with 28,000 sources. And on average, there are about 12,000 new wells constructed annually in Minnesota. That's not true in this current economy. The current numbers are down in the 6,000 to 7,000 wells per year in the last year to 2 years. There are 450 licensed well contractors that we work with, and there are 97% compliance rate for new well construction. And when we regulate well construction, we're doing it to protect groundwater from contamination. We're not doing it for the sake of regulating the use of the water. We're regulating the construction of the well so that you can't contaminate groundwater through poor construction practices, either the casing being improperly placed or the grout or the seal around the outside of the casing being improperly constructed. Also then, we collect and analyze more than 150,000 water samples every year for, this doesn't have the right number in there, I apologize, there's over 150 contaminants, sorry about that. Our water testing requirements for private wells are required only at the time of construction for bacteria, nitrate, and arsenic. We recommend annual treatment to owners of well, or annual testing to owners of private wells. These are the three contaminants that can do that have been shown to have the most serious and consequential acute effects, meaning serious illness or death resulting from exposure. We're going to talk now about health risk assessment, which is our health risk limits, and this is a very scientific conversation. We'll begin. It's about understanding what health risk assessment is. It's trying to understand the adverse effects of exposures to hazardous substances and chemicals on people. And so we're not talking about environmental quality issues. That's really an issue for the Pollution Control Agency and the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. We all, when we talk about a health risk limit, we talk about a concentration of a substance in water. For example, 0.3 micrograms per liter, that's a part per billion, is the health risk limit for PFOA, perfluorooctanoic acid, which is one of the chemicals 3M manufactured and disposed of in Washington County. These are the statutory authorities related to our program to establish health risk limits. They are grounded in the Groundwater Protection Act in 1989. There's the Health Standards Statute of 2001 that required us to take special care to emphasize issues concerning susceptible populations, such as pregnant women, infants, and children. And then there was a law passed in 2007 that required the department to establish water level standards that are either the lower of the federal maximum contaminant level or the state's health risk limit, whichever is lower. And we were required to establish rules for commonly detected contaminants beginning this March 1st, and we've been successful at doing that. Again, I'm going the wrong way. I apologize for that. Health risk limit, as I said before, is a concentration of a groundwater contaminant or mixture of contaminants that can be safely consumed daily for up to a lifetime. And health risk limits are used to address contamination of groundwater and evaluate risks to public health for unregulated contaminants. Unregulated contaminants would be those for which there isn't currently a federal standard. We use our health risk limits to establish standards before the federal government may get around to it. For example, we established health risk limits for PFOA and PFOS this last year, and that was in advance of the US EPA doing that under their authority. These are just the way that we calculate our values, and a health risk limit is a function of toxicity, meaning how toxic the substance is and how much you're exposed to it, your intake. We use in our rule update for this current health risk limit rule revision, we're moving from an old methodology that relied only on chronic data, meaning the exposures that you would have over the course of a lifetime, to those that might be less than lifetime exposures, meaning early developmental stages of life or other periods of the exposure. We're also changing from a default intake rate that considered only adults drinking water consumption to one that uses data-derived intake rates for higher exposures to infants and children. The cancer algorithm is really two forms. There's as I should have pointed out here, there's non-cancer causing constituents in groundwater, and then there are cancer contaminants of the risk. And the cancer, there's really a significant change in our rule here. We've tried to address what's called linear and nonlinear carcinogens. A linear carcinogen is a carcinogen for which there's really no exposure that does not result in the risk of forming a cancer, whereas a
Nonlinear means there may be a level, a dose below which there's no risk of cancer occurring. There are also some age-dependent adjustment factors and also chemical-specific information that we'll be using in our rule revision. There is a number of updated guidance materials from a variety of sources that we used in developing our updated rule, and this is just a partial listing of those for toxicity and exposure. And you can see by the dates of these references, they're very recent, and we use those to develop our methodology, our calculation, as well as carcinogen assessments, also again looking at these dates, very recent, recently published guidelines both from the federal government and other states that have been used to address cancer risk. So in revising our rules, and our rules are currently, we held a hearing on the rules in October. They're currently awaiting signature in the governor's office. We anticipate signature and implementation of the rules that we'll be talking about just momentarily. But we went through an extensive consultation period, and this is just a summary of those consultations we held with a variety of stakeholders internally and externally. We've broken down our rule revision into kind of three phases. Our first phase is 21 chemicals that we've published updated values for in our current rule revision. Our second phase will be on high to medium priority chemicals that we would expect to be developed in the next 2 years, and then our third phase would be a 2 year period after that. So we're going to be in rule revision on our health risk limits for the next 4 to 5 years. This is a list of our current rule updates. We've updated values, health risk limit values for these chemicals based on new scientific information and the new methodology that we've established looking at additional scientific data and methods. And this is an example of how we use these risk limits to identify for communities what they should or should not be concerned with in terms of drinking water exposure. This is the area of Washington County, South Washington County. Representative Bigham and Representative McNamara are very familiar with this map. Identifying concentrations of contaminants in the groundwater, and those areas then that exceeded the health-based values are identified in red, and they're very small for PFBA on this map. Using the health, our health risk limits and our health-based values, we can help communities understand those populations that are at risk and make choices about treatment and future decisions. All of this is fairly thoroughly described in our website, and we wanted to give you that information in case you wanted to follow up and do additional investigation. But Mr. Moyer is here to answer any detailed questions. Since I knew the list of chemicals might generate some questions, we could certainly respond to those questions in the time remaining.
Mr. Stein, we've got a couple folks, but just to clarify the step on your on the 21 chemicals you have here, we had a briefing for legislators at your office, and you on the website, I think you show all the math, right, on how you calculate this formula?
That's correct. Okay. That is correct, Mr. Chair. We actually have very detailed memos describing how these values are calculated. Previously, our values were calculated assuming a very a lifetime exposure at an adult intake rate. Our values are now based on varying exposures and the appropriate intake rates for those exposures. So there's actually kind of a matrix of values and a matrix of values that you'll see in our corresponding documents that go with each of these chemicals.
So if you can read, understand the math, it's all right there for the assumptions.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bigham, and then Representative Wagenius, and Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bet you thought it was your lucky day, Director Stein, as you were talking about contaminated drinking water, and I wasn't in the committee, so imagine your surprise when I walk in as the new member. So don't go to the casino tonight. Yeah, don't go to the casino tonight. first, thanks for all your work on the water in our area. Quick clarification, and then I have two questions. One, for those that may be watching from the East Metro today, PFBA is not on your proposed HRL list yet because it's a health-based value. So I just wanted, if you could confirm that, just to alleviate any confusion.
Mr.
Chair, Representative Bigham, that's correct. The health-based values and other health risk limits that are already in place from our 1993-1994 listing of health risk limits remain in place and are used in evaluating risk of exposure.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bigham.
Two questions. One, how has the biomonitoring program, I know that it's kind of ongoing, but how do you see that playing into the drinking water situation? And two, a huge concern of mine, and I know that Chair has a big concern about this too, is pharmaceuticals in water. I am just wondering if you could comment on that, if the department has any plans or agenda to address that issue.
I do, but go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bigham, regarding biomonitoring is the collection of human samples to evaluate the presence of chemicals in human beings. There are two pilot studies going on in Washington County of two populations of 100 people who have been exposed to PFCs through drinking water exposure. The first community is Oakdale City Water System, and the second is people on private wells throughout Washington County area affected, looking at seven different PFCs. That information will help us understand the degree to which that population compares to national values that were collected under the CDC's NHANES, the National Health and Nutrition Evaluation Summary Survey. It looks at how does this population of people compare to the national average of those compounds in their bodies. It may lead to additional inquiry and investigation relative to what's the sources of that exposure. Beyond that, its relevance to health risk limits is rather remote, but it does help us focus on additional questions where we may need to look at development of health risk limits if we're seeing a highly exposed population. Your second question on pharmaceuticals, we are interested in emerging contaminants, and the governor's budget does include a proposal to fund additional staff and resources for the Department of Health to look at emerging contaminants in groundwater. And that is an effort to characterize those compounds for which there are currently no standards in our health-based values, health risk limits, or in federal law. So that would be exploring the information that's available, toxicological information, and characterizing the risk as we do in our development of health risk limits. So that is a keen subject of interest for the department is moving forward with that.
Have Representative Bouguinius.
Well, thank you. I noted on your sheet that you had relied substantially on EPA in making your determinations. And the U.S. Government Accountability Office just released a report saying that EPA lacks even basic information to say whether chemicals pose substantial health risks to the public. And then it went on to say that the agency's programs to screen chemicals that damage the endocrine disruptor system had failed to screen a single chemical in more than 10 years after the program was launched. So now that we know that EPA's work has been discredited, how are you going to go back and adjust for all your reliance on EPA?
Mr. Stein.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Levinas, the documents we refer to are, while I have seen the GAO report, I understand its criticism. We believe that the science behind the studies that were and recommendations given by EPA on risk assessment were credibly completed with scientific rigor. That being said, the statement you quoted regarding their failure to address endocrine disrupting chemicals in risk assessment, we we agree with that, and we want to move forward in doing risk assessment of our own through our additional work that the governor's budget would support. We know that there are parts of EPA that have not provided the public with the information that is expected. We believe, though, that the scientists behind that, that are working diligently to produce some of the technical documents, are reliable, and we have chosen those because of that. I also would ask if Mr. Moyer has any comments to contribute on the subject.
I would agree with
Mr. Moyer, could you state your name and affiliation for the tape, too, please?
My name is Paul Moyer. I'm an environmental research scientist with the Minnesota Department of Health and project manager for the health risk limits for groundwater rules. I do agree with what Director Stein says. The technical documents that we are relying upon are vetted through peer review. So the concepts of looking at determining a reference dose or intake rate or the current state of risk assessment, we don't have an issue with that the way that the GAO has with other aspects of the EPA process. What I would also add is that the endocrine disruptors present a special challenge. The data that's coming out while indicating a potential for harm is not data that makes itself readily available to risk assessment because these chemicals are somewhat different in their action than a normal dose response type chemical would be. And so interpreting what the results in animal studies means to humans becomes even more difficult than normal. And we are looking at this. We're very interested in following it, but we're also not quite where we want to be to make determinations on some of the data that is available.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You go ahead.
Mr. Stein, I have just a couple questions. One of them is coming along right behind what Representative Gingrich just asked. And if given the uncertainties that we do know about, do you include extra safety factors beyond what EPA has written into their formulas for children, particularly? I think there's a safety factor of 10 in some of those formulas, if I recall right. Because do you do something additional for uncertainty there?
Chair McGarner.
Mr. Moyer.
We do apply uncertainty factors. We look at the entire database of information available for a chemical. One of our major changes in this rules revision was, as Director Stein pointed out, we are no longer relying solely on a chronic exposure, but we're looking down to data that may be available for even a one-day exposure to know how that may affect a developing child fetus due to that exposure. And so by looking at those shorter time frames, we feel that the uncertainty factors, if they're still warranted, that we apply are adequate, and that those are the ones recommended by EPA. So we do not apply a extra uncertainty factor, but we apply them appropriately depending on the amount of data available for each chemical.
Do you have a follow-up, Representative Stone?
Please, Mr. Chair, what then, how do you address the other two issues, and if you don't use that extra uncertainty factor, one would be cumulative, that we have more than one chemical at a time, and just are you using additivity, or just, you know, how do you address it? That's one. I'll give you two questions in this. Are there chemicals on your list here that you know that there's no safe level?
Mr. Moore.
Mr. Chair, I'll answer the first one by saying that we do use additivity. We group by endpoint, so chemicals that affect the liver would be grouped, and they would be grouped by duration of exposure. So a chronic liver toxicant would be grouped with another liver toxicant chemical, and that's what would be added together. And that is what we recommend, and that is also an EPA recommendation. We have been following other approaches, but we, again, are not at the point where we feel we can apply that yet. So, but we are keeping, you know, sort of our eyes out for whether there's a better approach. But additivity is what we recommend right now.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Purcell, if I could follow up on the second question.
Oh, okay.
Is there a chemical on this list for which there is no safe exposure? We respond to that differently. There is no thing as no risk. There is a continuum of risk from very low to very high, and the dose makes the poison, if you will. So these compounds that we've identified are identified because they're present in Minnesota groundwater, because the agencies managing this groundwaters of the state have agreed that these are the highest priority chemicals for us to evaluate for health risk. There are another 100 plus or minus compounds for which there are either current values or values under development, and those values will be included in future rule revisions.
Representative Stowe, we got just a couple minutes left.
Quick, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Well, you went to where I wanted to go. Thank you. The dose makes the poison, and of course that's not reality. The fetuses, and that's where I was headed with that. And you know, we know day 35 to 55, roughly, high cell development in the fetus. That, you know, a woman might not know she's pregnant or whatever. So we get there's a heck of a risk there. That's where I was headed with that. If you know that there are some that have been tested at that level, it's not for you and me, it's for fetuses.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, as Mr. Moyer pointed out, where data exists for that kind of exposure and that kind of risk, we use it, and we will develop our values accordingly.
None known at this time, though.
There are chemicals on this list that have developmental effects, yes.
And you certainly can check out their website for some of the procedures they went through for it. Representative Venus, last question, last word.
So, when you were talking about additives, do you take something and when it has known degradants, do you add those to it?
Mr. Moyer?
Mr. Chair and Representative McGinnis, what we would do in the case of a degradant is if it's present in the sample, we are working to prepare health risk limits for those. And for those degradants which there is not a health risk limit, we would use the parent value. So if, in the example of, say, let's use atrazine, where its current health risk limit is 3, the DACT degradant would also be held to 3. And we would use that as the additivity value.
Final question, Representative Wiggins.
Well, okay, he brought up atrazine, I thought these were new rules. The atrazine limit was established in either 1992 or 93. So this isn't very new. Certainly, that's when the original rule was done and before we knew anything about endocrine disruptors.
Yeah, we did. Okay, well, thanks very much, Mr. Stein and Mr. Moyer. I look forward to speaking with you further during the session. Thanks, Mr. Chair, for letting me chair, and this meeting is adjourned.